Welcome to the Merlin Podcast, bringing Europe's fresh waters back to life.
And without water, we are nothing. We are 80% water. Streams and rivers are drivers of all the other ecosystems, help to all other ecosystems. So we have to protect them.
Restoring nature is a task that's never really finished. Science progresses, governments change, technology advances, society shifts, and funding pots appear and disappear. And all the time, our rivers, lakes, streams, and wetlands are a constant, their fate determined by the choices we make about them. In a time of rapid ecological loss and the ongoing climate emergency, it can be hard to think hopefully about the future of our ecosystems. However, in this podcast, we're going to hear from four inspirational young scientists who are helping restore Europe's fresh waters, and with it, hope for the future of our natural world. The four scientists all work on the EU Merlin project, but each have their own research focus. We'll hear about the challenges of bringing disparate communities together through restoration, about fostering exchange and collaboration between different people, about thinking creatively about funding restoration in the future, and about strategies for bringing the public and policymakers on board with ambitious restoration programmes. And as you'll hear, the thread that runs through all these themes is the need for good communication in order to foster positive change for the future. I'm Rob St. John, and we'll start by hearing from Miriam Coles from the University of the Basque Country in Spain. Miriam works on removing obsolete barriers from small streams across the Basque Country.
I think that when we are talking about barrier removals, most of the problems that we have to solve are not ecological or technical, are more like social problems, or socio-political problems, more related with the perception that the society have on this type of restoration actions. Especially here in the Iberian Peninsula, that is an area that usually suffer some drought episodes. Talk about removing barriers. The society perceives that as we want to drought, not to dry the Iberian Peninsula. And it's not true, because this type of barriers and obstacles have no use, are obsolete, and have any maintenance. That this is also really important. You have to maintain the things, the structures, otherwise become obsolete. And because of that, we are saying that are obsolete barriers, but explain all these issues to the society, that they are producing an impact to the stream, and we have to balance cost benefits. Sometimes it's really hard.
If you're a long-time listener of the podcast, you will have heard Miriam's colleague Arturo Elisegui talk about these issues back in episode 8. And just as Arturo also highlighted, a big challenge is to listen to concerns local communities might have about barrier removal, and to communicate how it can significantly benefit both nature and people.
And I think that this is one thing that we as a scientist have to improve, our capacity to communicate, not to the scientific public, to the researchers, our knowledge, also to communicate our knowledge to the public, to the society. I'm always thinking on, okay, try to explain that to your grandma, for instance. No, if my grandma is able to understand what I want to say or not. I think that here it's important also the aesthetic value of the stream, and that for a lot of people, the aesthetic value of our streams or these barriers in the streams have this aesthetic value. To me, a natural river is more aesthetic than a river with a barrier, but some people consider that no.
This is an important point. Environmental debates are rarely only about the science. They're also formed by social, cultural, and political histories and perspectives. And in this case, preferences over how the landscape looks. This complexity means that each restoration project is a stepping stone towards what Miriam terms a dam removal movement.
I mean, in the beginning of the project, our objective was to remove dam barriers in the main river, in the main section of a river. And probably we will be able to remove 8 of these 10. To me, this is a success. But obviously, we are not able to achieve our initial proposal, that was to remove these 10 barriers. And the reason is that is the social opposition. We are not able to remove this all these 10 barriers because of that, because of the social opposition. But I think that with this project, we achieve another objective that at the beginning of the project, we never thought, that is that we start a dam removal movement in the basin. The people and the society is starting to talk about that. Other municipalities are asking to the public administrations to remove barriers. So maybe we are not able at the end of the project to remove all of our 10 initial barriers, but maybe we initiate something more important and more special, that is this dam removal movement.
Miriam describes how this inspiration and information can ripple out to meet fellow dam removal movements across Europe.
And to achieve these long-term effects of your restoration actions, far from the project, from the Merlin, and doesn't matter at the end of the day, the Merlin project or the name of the project, but to achieve this long-term effect of your actions, you have to convince the society to generate a movement. Yeah, I think that when we are talking about this movement, this barrier removal movement, we are not talking just about this physical movement to remove barriers in the streams. We have also to remove barriers, social barriers, mental barriers, psychological barriers, a lot of barriers we have to remove.
And the key to navigating this array of barriers in restoring freshwater ecosystems is open and honest communication.
To me, the good days are when people that you never met before ask you about your work, about what is happening there. What is happening with this village, with this municipality? It means that the diffusion of your work is working, not to say something, that the people is understanding and is worried about what is happening in some place. It's really important to talk and to talk with everyone, but convince to everyone is impossible. I think that this is the first one. And the second one, in our case, we have a really good relationship with the Gipuzkoa Provincial Council, that is the public administration working with barrier removal. And I think that in our case, receive the support of the public administrations is a key thing.
Miriam identifies the key role environmentalists can play as the mediator in these situations, helping bring together communities, industries, and policymakers to listen, communicate, and make good decisions about their freshwaters.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that we are underestimating this position, the mediator position, that we need this type of actors in our restoration actions. And I don't know if all the restoration actions have this fever. It's not easy to talk, to explain, always maintaining the good mood, always saying the things in the good way. I don't know if everyone can do this work.
I'm struck by the complex role stream barriers play in the ecological and cultural landscape of the Basque Country. It's inspiring listening to Miriam talk about the thoughtful role of the mediator scientists can play to help catalyse positive environmental change in the region. Andrea Schneider works in a similarly complex landscape in Germany. Andrea's work at the University of Duisburg-Essen focuses on restoring the Emscher River, which flows through a landscape which has been dominated by heavily polluting industries for years.
Even though we are having biodiversity hotspots, the industrial part is still there. So we don't have the space really to bring it back in a natural state, because there are many people living here. We have industry here. So the challenge is to focus on what can we do with, what are the options that we have left within this really densely populated region. The dikes are mainly for flood protection. So we have them anyway, and they have to be maintained for flood protection reasons. And the thought of that was, okay, can we do it differently to maybe enhance biodiversity? And that is always connected with costs that comes on top.
Andrea's questions resonate with those asked by restorationists working in similar heavily modified human landscapes. How can ecosystems be brought back to life in such a polluted landscape, whilst at the same time, how can human concerns like flood protection be ensured? Restoration work along the Hampshire has included the creation of wildflower meadows on the river's banks, with the aim of encouraging biodiversity whilst minimising flood risk. Like Miriam, Andrea emphasises the need for long-term exchanges of ideas and findings between restorationists working across different regions.
That's nice to see. And also it's great in this project that we have not only the ecologists, but also people from other fields, from other study fields. So maybe sometimes we haven't thought of a problem or a solution, and the exchange is really what I guess will help us in the future for multiple sites.
And again, like Miriam, Andrea outlines how communication is key to this process, not only in talking to other scientists and decision makers, but also, crucially, in helping the public understand why these issues are so vital.
I guess because we're our society. So if the ecologists stay in one bubble and agree on one topic, I guess that won't change so much. So the understanding and bringing the topics and the outcomes to a broader range of people that then get into action, or even if topics become more important for them. So, for example, vote accordingly, because topics are more clear and not just unknown. I guess that's the major thing of communication, so that a broader range of people know what's going on and then go into action.
This is a key point. Good science communication is the basis of democracy. It empowers the public to make informed decisions at the voting booth and to take action for the environments they care about. And as Andrea emphasises, with support behind them, restoration projects in landscapes like the Hampshire can catalyse visible, positive change in a few short years.
Yeah, I would say freshwater ecology is all around us. So in our neighbourhood, we have it. So it's, in the everyday life, we can see the change there, especially here, like having the Hampshire, which was a really smelling stream a few years ago. And it has changed within a short period of time. And I think what would be interesting for younger generations is that they can see what happened right in the last year, so that they feel the change, that they have the feeling something is going on, something's getting more positive.
It's inspiring to hear Andrea talk about her experiences working on the restoration of the Hampshire. The images of the restoration of its floodplains, where wildflowers now bloom on formerly industrial sites, gives me hope that such forward-thinking restoration work can really foster positive change. Vivian Cavalcante's work aims to ensure that ambitious restoration projects like this have sufficient funds to meet their goals. Vivian's research, undertaken through Deltares in the Netherlands, explores how financial support for restoration can be found in alternative places to the traditional government grant.
I think the most important topic would be to ensure continuity, because Usually the freshwater restoration NBS type of projects, they depend on project-based funding. So what happens is that after the project funding finishes, usually the restoration managers, they have to pursue new grants or new ways to ensure the continuity of the measures that they already implemented, and also to cover the OPEX costs of the monitoring and implementation, which would be the operational and maintenance of the measures that were implemented. So I think this is like the main aspect of why this is very important. So they don't rely only on grants and project-based funding, so we can ensure the continuity of the measures that were implemented as well.
As Vivian suggests, restoration projects are often only funded for a finite period, despite requiring many years or even decades to have an impact. Her work explores how new forms of private finance, for example, from businesses and investors, might help support restoration in the long term.
I think in Merlin, what we are trying to do is to go a little bit beyond grants. So also ensuring that stakeholders like companies that are benefiting from the restoration measures can also be more involved in the sustainable finance cycle for nature. So it's more of a systems thinking approach to integrate agriculture, urban planning, climate resilience, all of the different topics that are part of the restoration as well and that benefit from it. Kind of thinking a little bit beyond of restoration as a in the biodiversity silo, but also within the whole socioeconomic ecosystem and domain around it. So to include some sort of blended finance, which is kind of mixing the public and the private sources of funding to ensure continuation or payments for ecosystem services, since the ecosystem services are being used by someone, right? So it's more than fair that people would pay to keep that services alive and afloat and ongoing.
As we've explored in previous podcasts, this melding of the ecological and the economic doesn't always seem like an easy process. However, as Vivian highlights, the nature-based solutions idea gives a useful framework for communicating how restoration can be profitable, both for nature and for people.
It's kind of thinking, how can we live one with nature? Because we are also a part of it. So how can we, I'm not sure if use is the correct word, but how can we both balance it out? Since we are also using nature, how we can implement measures using what is already out there. It's like we don't have to bring infrastructure in sometimes because everything that we need is already part of nature. So how can we manage there that more sustainably and in a more just way, like socially just, you know, involving the local communities, ensuring the benefits are shared and etc. Because also now I think we have more of an understanding how, for example, restoration increasingly serve multiple goals. So it can serve flood management, drought resilience, inclusive development. So I think it's becoming more and more clear how freshwater restoration and other types of nature-based solutions can work towards climate resilience, how they are multifunctional, you know, and how they are also aligned with stronger policy incentives as well, because at least here in Europe, we have plenty of policy incentives.
This is an emerging theme, with many questions still to be ironed out. However, many environmentalists see great promise in the nature-based solution concept in mainstreaming ecosystem restoration into daily life.
Yeah, I think the extreme events have been helping in raising the awareness regarding why we can't just, you know, explore nature and keep the business as usual approach as we have been working in the last, I don't know, 15 years maybe. Also, I think the emerging technologies are making it easier for understanding as well the benefits of nature, of the benefits of nature-based solutions, freshwater restoration, conservation, and increase a little bit of transparency for the stakeholders, society, for investors.
One question, as ever, is over how best to communicate the nature-based solutions idea and the financial benefits it might bring to restoration investors.
One thing that we did that was quite helpful on our visit to the Sohaya case study was that we did this assignment, like a workshop with the case studies there, in which we had, I think, more than 50 different types of activities that could generate revenue for them. It's also a co-creation process, I think, because usually, of course, you have different types of experts. So, of course, you will have the expert who understands the biology, the ecology part, the biodiversity benefits, and etc. of the measure that they will be implementing, the technical part, how it affects the environment. But I think you also need the different parts as well, the different domains. So the socioeconomic actors who will benefit as well from those measures, and also the politics around it. So what type of regulations are in place that can actually work on the in favor of the measure, you know? So also having, I think, municipalities, state governments, even national governments involved in understanding also the regulation side around it can work in favor of the nature-based solutions or the freshwater restoration, the conservation measures that you're trying to implement. So having this understanding involving different types of stakeholders can actually help, because then everybody will have a different perspective of the measure, right? Because usually we see things from our sphere of understanding, our expertise, and then when we talk with someone else that has a different expertise, it feeds also your understanding as well. That is a bigger thing than your own thinking approach.
Vivian hopes that these experiments in blended finance for restoration will take hold in the years to come.
I think for me, what I would really like to be a part of is bridging this nature finance and society type of thinking. So helping designing a financing strategy, governance frameworks and models that can make restoration scalable, resilient in the long term. I think for me, that's what I would hope to come next and that I would try to work towards.
And for Vivian, this approach means we stand a better chance of restoring Europe's ecosystems in the future.
I think for me, a call of action maybe to all of my peers, people working with restoration, with nature-based solutions, so we can keep going and to not give up. Although times have been a little bit difficult, I think we are walking towards a brighter future. I hope so, at least. And I think that the more people are aware of the benefits of restoration and more living within nature, because we are one, so the best, the more people have this understanding, so the more we can actually walk towards a brighter future, a more sustainable one.
This theme around how best to financially support freshwater restoration has run through the Merlin Project. You can listen back to episode 2, where we hear from so-called angel investor Paolo Andres on the topic, or to episode 5, where we deep dive into the economics of freshwater restoration. It gives me hope to hear from Vivian, who is navigating this complex field to help ensure a brighter future for our freshwater ecosystems. The need for open, honest, and informed communication in making restoration happen has run through the 3 interviews so far. For our final interview, we speak to Jocelyn Veronica Arega Espin from BOKU in Vienna. As well as being a freshwater scientist, Josie is a talented science communicator and helps run the communication and dissemination arm of the Merlin Project. I ask her how restorationists can best communicate their work.
Water is the reason we live, and we need this water in a good quality state at the least. So keeping our water safe means keeping us safe. And in a way, as long as we have this water safe, we have a reason for hope. So for people doing science communication, also on social media, I would recommend to keep it short, because this is the idea behind social media. They want short content that people fully watch or fully read, and then they want you to keep it scrolling.
As the interviewees we've heard so far have highlighted, communication about restoration is often about getting out and talking to people, whether in public forums, policy debates, or just discussions along a riverbank. But as Josie highlights, so much of how we consume information is now through a screen. So restorationists need to be comfortable in using online channels like social media to craft and share their messages.
If people look like something is really long, they say, okay, no, I'm not going to watch this now, I leave it for later. They close the app, this post will not get boosted. So yes, keep it as short as you can. Also, if you want people to read more about this, you always add a link. And if people are interested, they will click on the link. Using images as well. This is the first thing people will see, and then they will read your text. So the image is really important to have. If it's a video, of course, also even better. And using hashtags related to your content, because you attract people in this way and you spread also your content in this way.
Just as Andrea highlighted, Josie suggests that such work is important for environmental democracy, to help foster engaged public audiences who will support nature restoration.
We are learning now from all of the things we are doing, and we can use this knowledge in the future. I'm expecting, of course, to have more legal frameworks, to have more politicians willing to support nature, and also to have people aware of their choices. What I would like as well is to have more people linking the degradation to its cause, to address the root of the problem, because we can always restore. But do we always want to restore while we are also supporting the main cause of the habitat degradation? According to the Living Planet report from 2024, the main cause of wildlife loss and habitat degradation is our current food system. And this is something we support every single day at home. So every single day we can make a choice for a better planet. But we can use all these tools and all these platforms to reach, the taxi driver or the flight attendant who might not be aware of the same issues. And I don't know how this is developing in 25 years, but I'm sure we can use this to inspire younger generations, because they are the ones to stay and they are the ones who then will inspire more people in the future. And this is really important.
The idea of communication as a form of democracy also relates to making scientific information more open and accessible to the public. Josie highlights this as a key focus for scientists seeking to make real change happen through their work.
So for me, good scientific communication is really important to build trust and to build awareness, because as everything, there is already misinformation online, and we need to fight this in a way. But also we need to make people understand nature, how nature is working and what are we causing to nature, because within the scientific community, everybody is aware of this ecological footprint, for instance, but outside of the scientific community, there's people who don't know, okay? Or maybe they are aware of, let's say, climate change. Yeah, everybody is aware of climate change. But do all the people know how to help? What to do at home to fight climate change? Or are they just disconnected because they don't know what to do? They are not scientists. They are not within this bubble. We need to reach everyone. And, at the end, we depend on policies, we depend on legal frameworks, and for this, we need public action. And for this public action, then we just need to make everybody understand. We need to reach all the people.
Across Miriam's Basque Country streams, Andrea's industrial river restoration, Vivian's financial networks, and now Josie's communication strategies, we hear the need for restorationists to engage with ever wider groups of people in order to get their work done. This makes sense. If the often repeated ambition is to mainstream freshwater restoration, then it follows that engaging with everyone, from the public to policymakers, with the message that restoration can benefit both people and nature, is key. As each of our inspiring interviewees has outlined, these processes of communication and collaboration can be slow and complex, and often need to be tailored to individual groups influenced by the dynamics of where they take place. But, if anything, I'm heartened and hopeful by the voices we've heard in this podcast. If this is a sample of the emerging generation of restorationists in Europe, then the future of our freshwaters is in good hands. You can find out more about the Merlin Project at project-merlin.eu. You can also keep up with progress on social media and at freshwaterblog.net. The Merlin Project is funded by the European Commission's Horizon 2020 programme. This podcast was presented and produced by me, Rob St. John, and the theme music is by project coordinator Sebastian Burke's band, Scala. The background music is by Scott Buckley. Please do like, share and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And until next time, thanks for tuning in.